This is Word of Mouth from NHPR and Virginia Prescott. Globally, the prevailing form of polygamy is of one man with multiple wives, generally older men marrying younger wives. Social scientists have quantified that crime rates are higher in those cultures, with younger men having fewer prospects for family life. And it is no great shakes for young women. Often prepubescent girls are forced into marriage by culture, economics, and religion. Here in America, polygamy is associated with fundamentalist Mormons, with Warren Jeffs' harem of underage girls, or Big Love on TV. Absent from the conversation is the possibility that plural marriage could have deep feminist roots. Radical utopians in the Victorian era and progressive era anarchists and free love era feminists all renounced the tradition. Today, communities of women are championing polyamory as an alternative lifestyle. Libby Copeland traces the pro-female history of polyamory for Slate Magazine and joins us now from New York to tell us more. Libby, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So what you discover about this Oneida commune is a bit of a shocker in 1840s America, where something called complex marriage was required.
Yeah, it was fascinating. It came actually from a Christian tradition. The guy who headed this commune was kind of a radical Christian minister. And he basically decided that in heaven there was no such thing as monogamy, that angels, the people who lived in heaven were not being monogamous, and therefore to live without sin down on earth meant that monogamy, we couldn't practice monogamy either. So he set up this commune in upstate New York, of all places, and at its height about 300 people lived there in the heart of the Victorian age. And they practiced something called complex marriage, which meant that they were all married to each other at the same time. And that meant that they could, be intimate with each other one at a time, but whenever they wished. And there were some logistics to it. It had to be approved by higher-ups, but it was a really radical sort of situation that functioned for close to 30 years. And authorities knew about it, and tourists knew about it. And tourists used to come to the grounds to tour the place and have strawberries and cream and wonder what the beds looked like inside.
how do you figure this was empowering to women?
Well, what's interesting about it is that for its time, this was a fairly progressive setup for women. Older women were in the practice of showing young men how to engage in spiritual lovemaking. The men were responsible for birth control by various means, and the women were in charge of the newspaper, one of the factories. They were, because children were limited, they didn't spend a lot of their time actually having to, take care of children. And so as a result, they had a lot of, sort of free time to, to kind of pursue things that a lot of women at their time didn't have time to pursue because they were tied down with domestic duties.
Some of the keys there, the progressive era, we saw in the more modern bohemian modernist kind of sexuality among some women bucking tradition. Mm-hmm. Polyamory, again, mentioned in your article in the 1970s. When the whole free love thing was happening, and in San Francisco in the 1970s also, another group of polyamorous led by a man. Now, how does this become a woman-identified movement?
Well, it was also, like Oneida, it was also headed by sort of a charismatic domineering man. So that's certainly part of what's going on. But at the same time, it was a very egalitarian place where, people, it was in the heart of the 1970s, this was a community where they were having children and they committed themselves to, gender neutral parenting, gender equal, relations. And so it was a very kind of, it came out of a feminist tradition, and it was committed to the idea that men and women were equal. Whether in practice that really played out is another matter, but this was a commune called Carista that actively tried to be sort of progressive and egalitarian.
Now, a contemporary wave of internet sort of connected and, I guess, abetted polyamory. Any idea of the numbers now?
It's hard to say. There's a scholar named Elizabeth Sheff who has said it's in the probably low to mid hundreds of thousands, which would make it more sizable than contemporary polygamy in the United States, which is interesting because during the Warren Jeff scandal, you tended to hear a lot about polygamy and with the show Big Love on HBO. And if, in fact, polyamory is more common, it would stand to reason that we should be hearing a little bit about it as well. And actually, in the last few years, you have seen some articles and television sort of specials on polyamory and how it plays out. Definitely comes from sort of the left side of the political spectrum and a more progressive tradition. And in places like San Francisco and Seattle, there are neighborhoods of folks who are polyamorous. Pretty common there.
Yeah, and even the word poly, you can just drop that and everybody
right.
understands it. And this is the thing. We associate female empowerment, of course, with the ability to make many choices for one's own good. So how do poly women, as the term is now understood, mm-hmm. talk about advantages in terms of equality and empowerment? And, of course, with that comes child rearing.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, it's what's interesting about it is that, as you stated, you know, at the beginning, the polygamy is very often associated with one man and several wives. There's a Canadian journalist named Terry Gould who has noticed that among polyamorous couples, a lot of them are headed by women. Again, no numbers on it, but it is noteworthy. And as I was doing research for this piece, what I kept coming up with as I was reading articles about actual families was this. Sort of reverse harems with one woman at the head and two men or more married to her. And in those cases, if there was a child, very often one of the husbands was the child, the person who stayed home and took care of the child. And the other husband and the woman would very often be going out and working.
Well, coming from someone like me who finds it energy zapping enough to be in one adult heterosexual relationship, I mean, how do you manage things like space, jealousy? Are there kind of conventions for polyamory?
Yeah, you know, there are conferences that take place that are entirely devoted to these matters. So, for instance, how do you manage the sort of emotional logistics of making sure that all your partners are happy and feel communicated with? Who empties the dishwasher? Who is the breadwinner? There are money management issues. So, for instance, if, you know, there are three adults in a marriage and they all make different salaries, how do you manage the money? Do you write out the tasks on the fridge and someone has to, you know, wash the car every week and someone else has to make dinner? It's incredibly complicated and it seems exhausting. And a lot of polyamorists talk about the fact that if you were to go to a convention of polyamorists, contrary to what you might believe, it would not be a convention devoted to sex or swapping. It would be devoted entirely to talking through issues and trying to kind of like make your way through the emotional landmines and negotiations that are necessary in these complicated relationships.
Well, Libby, thank you. I think we're probably going to be hearing a lot more about this in the future.
I think so. Thank you.
Libby Copeland, contributor to Slate Magazine. You can find a link to her article, Polyamory and Its Surprisingly Women-Friendly Roots. It's a little bit about our history of polyamory that you might not know about here in America. That's at our multiple-partnered website, wordofmouthradio.org. Now, please do stay with us for Gay Media Going Mainstream. That's coming up after a short break on Word of Mouth. This is from New Hampshire Public Radio and, of course, online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.